Welcome to Medically Speaking, Auburn's own medical radio show. Oh. Medical radio show with host Dr. Mark Vaughn of the Auburn Medical Group and Larry Finney.
We're just taking our time here because
we're messing with Mike.
We're trying to get our engineer, get his blood pressure up.
Yeah, so we're pretending to not pay attention. But we hope you're not pretending to not listen. I mean,
I don't know if that came over the mic when he was yelling at us.
I was getting ready to have another heart attack.
Well, you're in good hands.
Well, I wish you all could see that, but we can't because we don't know the password of the computer to get you on the video. If we get it during the show, if anybody knows it, send it on in here. We'll put the password and we'll get you guys so you can actually see Mike having his heart attack. This is Medically Speaking Radio. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn, your host, and
I'm Larry Finney, his faithful sidekick, his Sancho Panza to his Don Quixote.
I was going to say, was that the Cisco Kid or
no? That was what was the Cisco Kid's. That was Pancho. He was also Pancho. Yeah.
But, okay.
His sidekick, yeah.
This is another week of medical information for the Foothills, since we are the voice of the Foothills. And along the lines of medical topics, I don't know of anything especially new or up and coming at Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. Dr. Bradshaw, are you aware of anything just here lately? I think we have some stuff coming up, but it's not quite here yet.
Okay.
Some news items there. What do you have in your hot little hand there?
Well, it has fallen to me, again, to come up with news. And I always pick quirky news stories. This one has to do with the dreaded five-second rule. Now, we're all familiar with the five-second rule, right? We're somewhere and we drop our food. And if it's on the deck for less than 5 seconds, we're good to go, right? We can pick it up. But what do you usually do? You brush it off or blow it off? If it's cat hair, I think you'd blow it off. Anyway,
I usually wash it off.
The contaminants, yeah.
Kitchen sink.
Oh, I know you. You're probably running it through, you know, bleach and stuff. But
I give it to the kids.
If they don't die, I'll eat some, right? Anyway, the controversial 5-second rule, the one that allows us to eat drop food if it's quickly scooped off the floor, you know, as if it's actually codified.
Is this actually written?
Yeah, right. It's a bunch of baloney, according to Clemson University food scientist Paul Dawson, who stirred up the long-debated issue in this month's National Geographic. Though previous research has shown we may have up to a minute to rescue certain types of spilled foods before it becomes contaminated.
Oh,
Dawson,
come on.
Yep, up to a minute. Dawson and his students made a strong case for the 0-second rule.
Yeah.
They found that salmonella and other bacteria can live up to 4 weeks on dry surfaces and be immediately transferred to food. Not a good thing, right? But you have to have a minority opinion. So the zero tolerance standard conflicts with the findings of two Connecticut College student researchers, who, yeah, here's their experiment. They sprinkled apple slices and Skittles candies in the college dining hall and the snack bar for 5, 10, 30, and 60-second intervals. The apple slices picked up bacteria after 1 minute. Nearly 5 minutes elapsed before the Skittles attracted any. So, what does that say about the safety of Skittles? They're bomb-proof. You can toss those puppies down anywhere, wait up to 5 minutes, and eat them. Anyway, the germs are everywhere. The kitchen floor is probably a 0-second zone. This is another doctor. Is probably a 0-second zone because the bacteria from uncooked meat and chicken juices are more hazardous than the soil bacteria outside.
Yes.
You agree? You agree with that? He says, talking away from the mic as he's playing with the computer. Okay, I'll keep vamping for you, Doc. Okay, listeners.
What's our password?
I don't know what the password is. The concept of watching radio on video just escapes me. It's kind of like listening to golf on the radio, you know? It's not something you would do. You know, we tell people we have a face for radio. So, you know, don't look behind the curtain. But he's going to dutifully put us on Ustream. I think he's about to do it.
Yeah,
so,
we're on.
So if you're curious as to what this mess looks like, you know, fire us up on Ustream. Tell them, Doc, what is it?
How to get to it. If you go to our website, which is medicallyspeakingradio.com, and then you click on, I see you doing it there, Victoria, and then you click on the little link to video, it'll take you to our Ustream feed, and you just click on it, and then you can see us live right
now. Watch if you dare. Okay. So, anyway, this guy had written a book called...
Victoria's Computer Says Tilt. Does that mean
yeah, that's it. For those of you who remember pinball machines, right? Author of Germ-Proof Your Kids. I think we're in a sort of an antibacterial world, you know?
We have some
antibacterial,
people are.
Yeah. Well, I came from the old school method where Mama spit-shined us. You ever have that happen? Did your mom
ever
spit-shine?
Oh, the Kleenex,
yeah,
she licks it, and then she...
Oh, she pulls out that wadded-up Kleenex at the bottom of her purse and spits in the corner of it, and why? Gosh knows where that's been.
Actually, my mom would make us lick it.
Oh, okay. Okay, listeners, listen up. There's going to be a quiz on this, okay? And, of course, you'll be rewarded for the high grade. If you can, later in the show, we're going to give the quiz. You'll give the answer. And in exchange for that, we will give you a certificate for dinner for two at Las Catarinas, Mexican restaurant in Nevada City. You okay with that? Okay, so here's the basic study information you'll need to know, and we'll have the quiz on this part. This has to do with germs. Just intuitively, though, Doc, where do you think that the filthiest, nastiest place thing in your house would be?
I would probably go with the kitchen counter because
kitchen
I'm
counter.
More concerned about what the bugs can do to you from preparing the raw meats than I am about stuff around the bathroom.
Oh, very good. Well, okay. The number of germs per square inch on a toilet seat, 49.
No, I'm not concerned about gross numbers. I'm concerned about which bugs.
Oh, okay. Well, these guys are counting the germs. They must have been accountants. The number of germs per square inch on a toilet seat is 49. The number of germs per square inch on an office telephone, 25,000.
Ooh.
The number of germs in the average kitchen sponge, 7.2 billion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The number of bacteria in our gastrointestinal tracts.
I look at SpongeBob in a whole new way now.
Yeah. Just don't go out with SpongeBob. 100 trillion bacteria in our gastrointestinal tracts. And... in our mouths, 100 billion. Ew. You'll never kiss again. You know, I think I'd take my chances with this kitchen sponge over the mouth.
You're going to kiss a kitchen sponge?
I don't know. Well, there again, though,
by this,
the toilet seat is the safest place, and I'm not exactly down with that. So, anyway. All right. Moving on. Oh, what other news story should we do? Do you want to do this one or this one? This one or this one?
Okay, you're holding two of them in your hand.
Let's do this one. This is the segue.
Okay.
Doctor's notes. Should you read your doctor's notes? This is from the LA Times this month. Patients' medical records belong to the patient. Patients can ask for copies of everything health professionals enter into their files. Did you folks know out there in Radioland know that? You can read your medical file, but would you want to? So the article goes on to say, so what would happen if patients had much easier access to doctor's notes? The answer to that question should become clear later this year. Researchers led by a team at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Massachusetts have launched a pilot program called the Open Notes Initiative. This program will allow about 25,000 patients in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Washington to read their doctor's notes on a secure internet portal. The patients and doctors will then fill out questionnaires about whether the project helped or hurt. So... there's the premise. What do you think? Would it be a handy dandy thing for your patients to be able to read their notes, or is that?
Well, the part that would be the most helpful from it is where we actually write in the note what it is we're recommending that they do to help with the situation. Or sometimes I'll even write a little bit about my thinking about what the next step is. For example, if we're not sure that something's going to work. Because it works, you know, say 70% of the time, I'll have written in there what the next step will be or when the follow-up is to check on how it's doing. And they already get that in our office because we have it on their discharge summary. It actually, whatever I type into the note on that part, automatically goes to them. So they wouldn't get a whole lot from our office.
Okay, so they wouldn't find anything outrageous in there. Some of the examples given in the article, you know, a doctor might write something like... Mr. Smith is typically in a foul mood and is convinced he's going to die. You know, I mean, you don't write
actually,
stuff
actually that,
like that.
That part wouldn't be in the discharge summary. So
no, that's what I'm saying though. Well, do you ever write things that are similar to that the patient would
you know if somebody was really like that where the foul mood if somebody was really in a foul mood and upset, I would document that was the case at that interaction because looking back at it in the future, it it's information you need to know to accurately know what was going on at the time in that patient.
Okay.
If that had to do with what was going on, you know, if it had to do with their emotional state, if it has to do with, you know, an infection in their toe, I don't see that that's especially relevant.
So, would you want to read your doctor's notes? Give us a call, 530-885-3565, or if you're out of the toll-free area, well, I'll give you a toll-free area, 1-800-950-5244.
We do have access to Big Cletus's notes from my office. If Big Cletus calls in and gives us permission to read them,
we'll post those.
He can tell us which visit to read, and we'll read it on the air for him.
Yeah, Big Cletus will be coming on after our show at 11, so stick around for that. Final news story, and this will be a segue to our guest today. This is getting around colon blind spots. Yeah, it's a nice sunny day here in Auburn, but today we're going where the sun don't shine. We're going to get around those colon blind spots. There's a new tool to spot a silent killer. The silent killer, of course, being colon cancer. This thing is called the third eye retroscope. And essentially, it gives the ability of the scope to look backwards.
You're talking about a colonoscope that you stick in the lower end to look up in the colon and the...
Yeah, I liken it, and after having read the description of it, I liken it to like the fancier SUVs that have the camera, the backwards looking camera, so that you have a video.
So you don't
screen.
Run over the little tricycle.
Yeah, so you don't crush the tricycle. Well, it's more like this. You're moving forward, so you can see what's in your headlights. But if you have no rearview mirror, you may pass something around these corners and nooks and crannies that you don't see hiding around the corner. But the camera will pick it up.
Yep.
The background is that this is a screening method, obviously, that, you know, you ought to start having your colonoscopies at age 50. Earlier, if you have a family history of colon cancer.
You just keep telling me that for another decade or so.
I know. An estimated 40 million Americans over age 50 are being screened. It's a silent disease that kills almost 50,000 every year. It's the third most common cancer in the world. Now, Dr. Bradshaw, our guest, will probably have some illuminating statistics on that. Did you know, doctor, that the colon is about 5 feet long?
Yeah, that's about right.
Filled with curves and folds?
I do have one patient who has one longer than that.
Longer than 5 feet?
Yeah.
How would you know that?
On colonoscopy, they gave a report that showed hers was long.
Wow.
I don't remember how long it was, but it was long.
Wow. So, the third eye retroscope. Because, allegedly, the old school method can miss 12 to 24% of potentially dangerous
spots. You sent me a little news video. Some local news station did the story on it, and they threw out that statistic, and that kind of blew me away to miss that many polyps on a traditional, and I really have a hard time believing that.
Well, having read this article and seen the internet page and so forth on it, I suspect, without evidence, that it's a press release in the form of news. I mean, you know, it's a promotional thing.
By whoever makes the third eye retroscope.
In fact, look at this. It says at the bottom, for more information, and it gives the company's name, phone number, and their website. So, it's the people who make the...
Yeah, and I have a question for Dr. Bradshaw about that when we get back from the break.
Yeah, we'll introduce our guest when we get back. We'll be talking with Dr. Barton Bradshaw, general surgeon from Sutter Auburn Faith.
That's right.
Here.
And here comes our lovely disclaimer.
If you would like to speak to our hosts about today's topics, please call 530-885-3565. That's 530-885-3565. We will return to Medically Speaking with Dr. Vaughn and Larry Finney after these messages on K-High, the voice of the foothills.
The content of this website and the Medically Speaking radio show are meant for entertainment and for general information purposes.
No doctor-patient relationship is attempted or implied through the show or the website.
Any medical advice, home remedies, and all other medical information on this website or radio show should not be treated as a substitute for the medical advice of your own doctor.
Do not attempt any treatment mentioned on the website or the show without consulting your doctor.
Always consult your own doctor if you are in any way concerned about your health.
If you need a doctor and live near Placer County, call Jen at 530-886-8630.
If you have a medical emergency, call 911.
Medically Speaking Radio, Dr. Mark Vaughn, Auburn Medical Group, KHI Radio and or our sponsors are not responsible for any diagnosis or treatment made by anyone based on any of the content of this website or the Medically Speaking Radio Show.
In addition, the views and opinions expressed on the show or on linked websites are not necessarily those of Dr. Mark Vaughn,
KHI Radio, the Auburn Medical Group Incorporated, or any of the show sponsors.
Few things in life are harder than thinking about serious illness or the death of someone you love. Research confirms that Americans want the basic services that hospice provides, care at home or in a home-like setting, treatment that preserves a sense of dignity and respect, emotional and spiritual support for patients and for their families, and effective pain management. Hospice helps patients and their families deal with end-of-life challenges in a life-affirming, compassionate way that brings dignity, hope, and love to every day of life. This message of love and caring is the focus of hospice care. This message is brought to you by Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice. We can be reached at 886-6650 or click on the link for Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice on the Medically Speaking Radio website.
Larry, have you ever been to Auburn Drug Company?
Yeah, that's the one with the marble soda fountain.
Welcome to Medically Speaking Way.
Yeah, right there in front they have a marble fountain.
And in back is an independently owned pharmacy right here in Auburn.
And that thing has been around for a long time.
Since the 1800s. They are so great because they actually fill your prescriptions when you ask them to, unlike the chain drug stores that make you wait.
You know, and waiting there wouldn't be a big crime because, heck, you could always go to the soda fountain. That's Auburn Drug Company at 815 Lincoln Way in downtown Auburn. Give them a call at 885-6524.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
You learn these things. Okay, we are back from the break, and it's good that our mics were off during the break, because now I know who Adam and Henry are. Okay, so this idea of the retroflexing third eye scope, we'll talk about with Dr. Bradshaw. Dr. Bradshaw is a general surgeon, is here in Auburn, has been. In fact, you're the senior general surgeon for all of Auburn, even though you're a young guy. In fact, I think I'm
getting older every day.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Last time you were on the show, we figured we were both in St. Louis either at the same time or just a year apart.
Very close, doing our training.
And you were in, I think you were in residency and I was in medical school.
I was in medical school from 1988 to 1992 at Washington University.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And then I started just the year after at SLU.
That's right.
Across town. And don't say anything that you guys used to say about SLU students.
No. We only the highest level of respect for our colleagues across town.
As far as all the rumors you used to hear about the SLU students, they're all true. So after that, you did residency where?
Seattle.
Seattle. And any fellowships?
No fellowships. I did 5 years of surgery training at Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle. And yeah, I was ready to get my first real job when I was 34.
And then, as we've said before, by the time you finished residency, some people estimate that you put in as many hours as some people do in half of their whole career. Is that how the estimate goes?
I guess. It was a lot.
Like that. Yeah.
It was a lot.
And so now you're here with your group, and your group's name is Sierra?
Sierra Foothill Surgical Specialists.
Sierra Foothill Surgical Specialist, and your office is located right on Professional Drive, just a rock's throw from the hospital.
A rock's throw from the hospital.
And from my office, which is why you have some broken windows, but that has to do with referral you guys didn't take. The idea of the retrovision third eye scope, when I saw this thing, hey, have you seen the video of it?
I have not.
You haven't seen a demonstration of it?
No.
Okay. The end of the scope, I'm going to demonstrate. For those of you on the listening on the radio, you have no idea what I'm doing. But the video people, you guys can see this. Okay. At the end of the scope, through one of the channels, a little, I'd estimate, 3 millimeter additional apparatus comes out, which is probably not too unlike the different tools you use inside of it, I would guess. You don't move the lights in and out, do you?
No.
It's as if one of those could come out, and then it immediately can turn and look back on itself with maybe a centimeter of it past the hinge. And it's very easily manipulated to go to any angle around. When I look at that, I think, well, isn't that what happens when you retroflex the scope anyway?
Yes, but, well, let me just point out, I think it's not necessarily intuitive. Usually the way they do these, the first part of the colonoscopy, they push the scope all the way in, and the colonoscope is about a yard long. And the first part, they're not necessarily looking for things. The first part is getting it all the way to the end of the colon. And then the time that they actually spend the time looking for polyps and abnormalities is when they pull it out. So basically, they're looking in reverse. And so the telescope, the actual visual part of the scope, is on the end, and it looks straight ahead. And you, as you pull it out, you basically pull it out, and you'll see the end of the colon, and then you'll pull it back, and there'll be a fold that'll come by. And you can move the end of the colonoscope and look side to side, but essentially you're looking in reverse. And you know, the analogy of the fancy cars now that have a little video screen on the back so you don't back into anything, it's similar to that. You're actually looking in reverse as you pull the colonoscope out of the body. And okay. So the advantage to this third eye thing, as I see it, is that you can get a little bit more range of vision rather than just looking behind you. You look to the sides. Now, usually in the colon itself, it's very hard to rectiflex a scope because you can do it down in the rectum because the rectum is generous enough in size that you can. And when we say retroflex, what we mean is you can actually, the colonoscope is such that you can make a U-turn with the scope itself and turn it in on itself and sort of look where, and you can see the scope.
Kind of a J curve.
It's a J curve of the end, exactly. Thank you.
Candy cane.
But you can't do that in every length of the colon. It's too small. It's too narrow. You can't retroflex the scope in the mid colon and pull it out.
Oh, okay.
Because it's too narrow. There. I think in the bulk of the colonoscopy would be very helpful. I don't think you can retroflex the scope and pull it out because that's like pulling a giant fishhook through your colon. That would be trouble.
Which we've all had cases like that too.
Yeah, that's an image I don't care to dwell on.
Bad fishing accident.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that the end of the article?
Well, yeah, we discussed the article for the express purpose, though, of Dr. Bradshaw is here to talk about
colon cancer.
Yeah, colon cancer surgery and so forth. But precursor to that is the screening, and we wanted to emphasize the importance of the screening, getting the screening at age 50. Now, is there any reason that a person, significantly younger than 50 would want a screening, say someone in their 40s or even 30s?
Sure, and that has to do with family history and genetic predisposition to develop colon cancer. The data are such that the vast majority of people that develop colon cancer are older than 50, and that's why the American Cancer Society and most of the groups that make recommendations recommend colonoscopy starting at age 50, because it's quite unusual to develop colon cancer before then. But there are certain hereditary groups that are at high risk for developing colon cancer, and those people it's recommended they get screening early. And the standard thing, I have a family member actually that was diagnosed with rectal cancer at age 32, my cousin, and her family asked me, what should we do? And, her family, meaning her dad and her mom and her little brothers and sisters, and there's a whole range of them. The American Cancer Society recommends screening colonoscopy starting 10 years earlier than the affected person was diagnosed. So for them, 22 and up. So that's basically the whole family. Everybody needs to be screened.
Well, yeah, but and that's a fairly, is that relatively uncommon?
That's uncommon. I mean, I can count in 12 years of practice in Auburn, the number of colon cancer people I've seen less than 40 is not many. I mean, it happens. But usually there are fairly defined high-risk groups that develop cancer early, and it's usually a specific genetic abnormality that predisposes them to develop cancer.
In your practice here in Auburn, is there a particular demographic? I mean, just anecdotally, what is a typical, shall we say, if there is such a thing, colon cancer patient?
Oh,
age-wise, gender-wise, et cetera.
Colon cancer affects men a little bit more commonly than women, but in general, it's both men and women, and they tend to be over 50, 60, 70. it can affect people, you know, people in their 80s and 90s too. And, you know, interestingly, in Auburn, which is the bulk of in the foothills, my patients tend to be a little bit older in general than my patients during my residency in Seattle. And I think that's the demographics of the area, that, that, you know, older, a little bit older people, a little bit of a retirement community, and those people are at risk for colon cancer.
Yeah. And speaking of older people, this is where I have an advantage over both the doctors. I have experienced the full colonoscopy. So I can speak from some experience, and happily it detected nothing. I got the magic see you in 10 years.
Excellent.
Yes. But I can assure listeners that who are maybe dreading the indignity, the prep, it's no big deal, really. And let's talk about relative risks, because I think people's decisions to do or not do something is based on risk. So they would probably balance the risk of, are there risks to this screening? Then there's the general, shall we call it, indignity, against the risk that they may actually have colon cancer. And, you know, this article says that colon cancer kills about 50,000 people every year. And I assume that we're talking just in the United States.
That's in the United States.
Yeah. What is one's risk of having colon cancer as opposed to whatever risks are associated with the screening?
Well, the risk of developing colon cancer in one's lifetime is thought to be, you know, 15 to 20% in your life. That's too high. Excuse me. It's not quite. But colon cancer, as you said, 50,000 people a year. And the problem with it is that it's oftentimes asymptomatic. You don't know you have it until it's advanced. And that's the whole purpose of screening, is that you can take a look, find the colon cancer, diagnose it early when it's treatable. And if you diagnose colon cancer early, most people survive that and go on to live long and healthy lives.
I'd like to jump on that concept of screening for people who don't have symptoms, because I really want to emphasize that to my patients specifically, because I have people oftentimes, when I'm introducing this topic of screening, saying, well, I don't have a family history, I'm not having any symptoms. And this can be for any screening. It can be for mammograms for breast cancer. It can be for pap smear for cervical cancer. It can be for a colonoscopy for colon cancer. We don't screen you because you have symptoms. That would be a diagnostic exam evaluation. It's done a little bit differently sometimes. Screening is because there is this inherent risk in people who have no symptoms whatsoever, and we can catch stuff early that is a threat. Colon cancer, what, third biggest cancer killer.
Correct.
Breast cancer, cervical cancer. These are things we can get a hold of. You'll notice I didn't include in that list prostate cancer, and the reason I didn't is because screening for prostate cancer just has not shown itself statistically to be as effective as these other three cancers. Not that we shouldn't be doing something to try to screen for it, but it's just not up there with those three. I'm sorry to interrupt, but...
No, that's great. It's interesting that we were talking before the show, when you talk about the cancer diagnoses in the United States, it's separate by gender. Breast cancer, of course, is the most common cancer in women, but similarly, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. And lung cancer is the second most common cancer in both genders. Colon cancer is the third most common cancer in both genders. And interestingly, in terms of the mortality associated with cancers, lung cancer is far and away the biggest killer of people by cancer deaths in the United States, because we don't do very well with catching it early and treating it.
And it's not that there's a way to do it that's great, we're just not doing it. It's just there's not an effective screening for lung cancer.
Well, and it tends to be a more aggressive kind of cancer, too. It's not as easily treated. We do pretty well with breast cancer. We do pretty well with prostate cancer. And we do pretty well with colon cancer.
So let's return to that concept of risk. Just on the natural, a person has roughly a 20% chance of contracting colon cancer. What are the risks associated with the screening?
As you talked about, there's some discomfort and unpleasantness associated with it, but those are, you know, you can, people do okay with that. There's a fairly clear, about a 1% risk of perforation of the colon with colonoscopy. And what that means is they take this yard-long scope and they push it in, and it has to go around corners and nooks and crannies, and sometimes it pulls on the colon a certain way and you can get a little tear in the colon. Most of the time that's associated with minimal injury to the patient, but sometimes it requires an operation to fix. And again, that doesn't happen very often, but that certainly needs to be weighed into the factor.
So it's like a 1 in 100 chance.
Yeah, that. 1 in 100 yeah. less 1 in 100 or less chance of a perforation.
Yeah. Probably need to get into a break here. I see yeah. Mike's about to, he's exhibiting heart attack signs again. He's giving us the break. That's not the Heimlich maneuver thing. He's not choking. He's saying break. Okay.
He's feeling a grabbing sensation in his arm there. Okay. Yeah, we can go ahead and have a break and we'll get back and just continue our discussion about colon cancer with Dr. Bradshaw.
Since 1966, Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital has been providing award-winning care to members of the community, to people just like you. The tradition of excellence continues today with our comprehensive family birth center, cancer services, 24-hour emergency care, and a whole range of outpatient services with convenient hours and locations to serve you.
In addition, we've been recognized for excellence in managing heart attacks, heart failure, pneumonia, and surgical care. We are one of a select few hospitals in the state to earn recognition from VHA's West Coast region for sustained outstanding clinical performance.
To learn more about Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, visit us on the web at sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio. That's sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio.
Sutter Health, with you for life.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I want to tell you about my dentist, Rodney Kihara. His office is located right in town at High Street and Auburn Folsom Road. His staff is pleasant. They smile when you walk in, and you know who they are because they're there every time. We're talking about Flo, Cheryl, and Judy. Their pleasant faces welcome you into the office and let you know that you're in the right spot, a comfortable place to go to the dentist. Call Dr. Kihara's office at 888-1966. That's 888-1966.
The doctor would say, don't stick anything in your ear. Unless, of course, it's medically speaking. On K-High, the voice of the foothills. Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Okay. And we'll come right back from the break with Dr. Barton Bradshaw speaking about colon cancer. We were talking a little bit about the scope and how it works and some of the statistics and reasons for doing cancer screening. If we're actually in there doing the colonoscopy, what is it that you're looking for, and what do you find?
Well, it's probably helpful to know the sort of underlying science that we understand about how colon cancers develop. We think that colon cancers all start in the cells that line the colon, the mucosa is what it's called. And those cells, we think, undergo some sort of change that in their DNA that causes them to develop polyps. And these are called adenomatous polyps. And those polyps aren't cancer themselves. And again, cancer itself is defined by ability of cells to start in one place and spread other parts of the body. You can get benign tumors that are big and ugly and cause trouble, but they're not cancer unless they spread somewhere else. So adenomatous polyps are abnormal growths of tissue, but they'll never spread to your liver. They'll never spread anywhere else. Something else changes in those adenomatous polyps to develop cancer, and adenomatous polyps are precursors to colon cancer. So we think it takes probably 5 to 10 years for this change in a normal cell develops into a polyp, which then develops into a colon cancer. It takes a fair amount of time. So ideally with colonoscopy, if you can find these polyps before they turn into cancer, that's the best of all possible worlds, because you've prevented the cancer from developing essentially by taking out the polyp. So And what these polyps look like, normally the lining, this mucosa of the colon, is sort of pinkish red and it's smooth, and the polyps look like gross and usually you can tell the difference between a polyp, adenomatous polyp, and a cancer, which tends to be rock hard and sort of whitish. And a lot of times it'll grow around the inside of the colon and sometimes even narrow it so you can't get your telescope through. So you're looking at anything from a really small little nodule to a frank cancer that's blocking the colon.
And then what do you do when you see this in there?
Well, the advantage of colonoscopy as opposed to other x-rays is that you can actually take a piece of it, and they have a little biopsy device, and it seems a little bit medieval, but this claw comes out of the end of the scope, and you just grab a chunk of tissue, and they pull it back through the telescope, and then send it to the pathologist, and the pathologist will look at the piece of tissue under the microscope, make some stains, and tell us what it is. It turns out that we don't have the same kind of nerve supply in the inside of our colon that we do on our skin or in our mouth or something like that. And if you take a chunk of from the inside of your colon, you basically don't feel it. And that's the way that we make the diagnosis, is by biopsying the lesions and then looking at them under the microscope and telling us what they are.
You had mentioned that there's an advantage with this form of imaging and that you can just grab a piece and take it. So these different technologies are being developed for alternate ways of screening that are less invasive, like the virtual colonoscopy, yeah, or the pill camera that you can swallow. They're missing something.
Correct. Virtual colonoscopy is essentially a radiographic technique with CT scans where they use special kinds of software programs that essentially take these pictures from a CAT scan and they reconstruct an image of the colon in three dimensions. It's pretty fancy software engineering to do it. And as you mentioned, they're good at detecting bigger polyps and cancers and things like that. They're in some early trials now to tell whether they're as sensitive as colonoscopy. But the obvious problem is, as you just mentioned, you can, even if you see something, you still got to do a colonoscopy to then take a piece of it and find out what it is.
I mean, yeah, still got to get a biopsy. So you might as well just go there in the first place.
Well, so I guess in theory, if you screen people with virtual colonoscopy and then people that were positive then subjected them to colonoscopy, you probably have a few less perforations, and what comes into play here is expense, and the virtual colonoscopy is expensive, and that, if you're talking about screening every American over 50, then that comes into play with money.
Is it more expensive than the classic colonoscopy?
I actually don't know the data. That I think it is, though.
And would the patient prep be the same?
Patient prep's the same.
Oh, okay. So you're really gaining nothing there either.
Yeah, what you gain is you minimize the risk of the colonoscopy itself.
If the price could be brought down enough, it would make sense to go ahead and do a virtual colonoscopy on everybody and have the ones that are positive come back.
If it's as accurate. But I think the data is, the jury's still out about whether virtual colonoscopy is as sensitive as the colonoscopy in detecting small polyps and early cancers.
Another technology we should also throw in here to discuss is the sigmoidoscopy. It's a shorter scope, doesn't go as far in the colon, and when it is used for a screening tool, the recommendations are to repeat it, even if it's clear, repeat it again every 3 years instead of every 5 to 10.
Yeah, the obvious disadvantage of this sigmoidoscopy is that you only look at about a third of the colon.
Yeah.
And the two-thirds that are most upstream, you don't see. The other advantage of the sigmoidoscopy is that most of the time people don't need conscious sedation. They don't need drugs to help them be sleepy when they do it, although... Dr. Bond's laughing.
I will vouch for conscious sedation. It's the greatest thing in the world. I went through the whole colonoscopy with that. I remember nothing. It's probably just as well that I don't remember anything. And, you know, the peace of mind.
I have got to throw in my argument for colonoscopy instead of sigmoidoscopy based on those patients who have had an in-office sigmoidoscopy and won't let me send them for any more screening for colon cancer again in their life, because of the experience with somebody doing their in-office sigmoidoscopy. Now, this is a primary care doctor, not a surgeon.
Well, but it's still, I mean, it's no fun to have that tube put in. And what we're talking about is that almost always during colonoscopy, they do it in the hospital or an outpatient surgery center. And you get an IV put in before you start the procedure, and then just before you go back to the room, they'll slip you a Mickey, and it's usually Valium or its cousins of benzodiazepines and a little bit of fentanyl sometimes for pain.
The nurse is sitting by you at the bar, and you turn away.
And, you know, people's response to this varies. Some people go to sleep. They're not unconscious. It's not a general anesthetic, but they just sleep through the whole thing. And they don't render you unconscious to pain, so that if you actually hurt somebody, they will wake up. But a lot of times the stimulation of the colonoscopy is such that they'll groan a little bit, but they won't wake up. There's other people that are talking the whole time. And they won't remember anything about what has happened. And they finish the procedure and say, man, that was great. And they've just had a whole conversation about different things. Sometimes they give us stock tips. Other times they tell us family secrets. But
I wonder
most
what
time
it would
they
be
don't
like
remember
to do a radio show while being consciously sedated. Or maybe there's some who argue we already have. But Mike is nodding.
That's the audience.
Yeah. We ought to try that one.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, a little clinical trial here.
Anyway, with the sigmoidoscopies, it's felt to be, you know, just the way it's done. Sometimes they don't think you need that, and it's a little bit easier not to put an IV in people. Although I don't know that you don't need it, because as Dr. Vaughn points out, nobody terribly comes away feeling happy after it.
Well, it just goes along with my entire bent personally toward being heavy on sedation and pain control and analgesia when doing procedures, in contrast to some doctors who prefer to use Brutane instead of lidocaine.
Maybe we've got to get into discussion of the surgery. So what happens, let's say, after all the screening and diagnosis and so forth, biopsies, we've gotten to that point where the patient actually needs surgery. What's the outlook for that patient?
Overall, it's good. The bottom line is, though, that the prognosis, which is the likelihood that the cancer is going to come back or that it's going to cause trouble down the line, the prognosis is related to the stage, and the stage is related to how far the tumor has invaded the bowel wall, whether there's been spread to lymph nodes or whether there's been spread elsewhere in the body. Colon cancers tend to go to the liver. The surgical techniques that we're using to take out colon cancers are better than they've ever been. And it's probably worth saying, just in general, with any kind of cancers, there's three modes of treatment: surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. And in general, with colon cancer, surgery is the primary mode of treatment.
Yeah, let's assume early detection.
Early detection, and again, there's a number of reasons why you want to do surgery on colon cancers. The first and obvious thing is to cure the patient, but secondly, you prevent obstruction. So one of the things that will happen eventually with colon cancers, and some people present with it, in other words, they don't get screened, and the first time they ever know anything's wrong is when they can't have a bowel movement, and they start vomiting all the time. And that's when the colon cancer has grown so tight that their stool can't get past the obstruction. And we obviously, that's a bad thing to happen to anybody. So surgery in general prevents that. Even if we can't cure somebody, if somebody has metastases elsewhere in the body, we oftentimes will do an operation anyway to prevent them from having obstruction, because, you know, we're all going to die sometime, but you really don't want to die vomiting your own stool. That's not good. And it's something, again, we spend a lot of effort to try to prevent that in patients. That's a bad problem. But with an early colon cancer, a lot of times we'll do a CAT scan first, and the CAT scan looks for evidence of spread either to the liver or to lymph nodes, and it kind of helps us plan our surgery. Most of the time now, for the past 10 years, 6 years, we're using a laparoscope to do the colon cancer surgery. And
Is this the one where you go in through the navel, or roughly?
The idea is that we use a telescope and little, you know, quarter inch to half inch incisions to do most of the surgery. And the advantage is that there's less pain and earlier recovery. Most people know that gallbladders have been taken out with a telescope now. Knee surgeries are done with a telescope. Gallbladders for the past 20 years. And since then, we've tried to take more and more out with the telescope. But the one problem with the colon is that the tumors are usually, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 inches big.
And too big to take out through a quarter inch hole.
You can't get them out through the tiny incision. So the most precise term is a laparoscopic assisted colon surgery. So you do the bulk of the operation with the telescope and these small incisions and long instruments. And then when you got the colon all freed up and basically the blood vessels divided and you're ready to take it out, you make an incision that's about a quarter of the size we used to make, and you take just the tumor out and you take it out and then you sew it back together the same way we've always done on the outside of the body. So the anastomosis, which is what we call the process of sewing two ends of colon back together, that's done on the outside. There was a huge national study that was done, international study actually, that was published in 2004. And that showed that this laparoscopic technique was safe and effective, and it worked as well as the old way. So since 2004, pretty much that's become the standard of care.
Okay. We're going to have to take our final break right now so Mike doesn't have another heart attack. And we'll be right back with Dr. Bradshaw after these messages.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I wanted to let you know a little bit about our practice at the Auburn Medical Group. The physician, nurses, and front desk personnel all approach the patient, asking themselves the question, how would I want to be treated if I was in the patient's shoes? Listen to what one of our patients has to say about her experience at the Auburn Medical Group.
My name is Susie Brown. I just want to sincerely thank that group of people for being there for me in some emergency situations. They are very efficient. Their staff, including their receptionist, even when you call her, she's got sympathy and compassion for you. And when you're ill, that's what you need. The nurses, the nurse staff is wonderful, and Dr. Vaughn listens to everything you say, and they just get on things. They do not let anything lag.
If you need a doctor, call us at 886-8630 or look at our website at auburnmedicalgroup.com.
Do you find yourself overspending, overeating, or in unhealthy relationships? Is your anger out of control, or do you struggle with drugs and alcohol? Are you tired of just trying harder to deal with your struggles? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there's help available. Celebrate Recovery is an international ministry that meets locally at Parkside Church, 3885 Richardson Drive, Auburn. Meetings are held every Friday night from 6 to 9:15 p.m. All areas of recovery are welcome. Celebrate Recovery is a Christ-centered, 12-step recovery program that offers real and lasting change. Contact Sheila Dobbin at 823-9911. That's 823-9911. For a listing of Celebrate Recovery locations, go to celebraterecovery.com. We invite you to join us at Parkside as we celebrate recovery.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
No, that's okay. Okay, we're back from the break. This is Larry Finney with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Dr. Bart Bradshaw on Medically Speaking. Now, I promised our listeners a quiz, and a prize for said quiz is dinner at Las Catarinas, dinner for two, so you don't have to eat alone, dinner for two at Las Catarinas in Nevada City. To the first caller who can correctly answer this quiz question. Now, earlier in the show, we were talking about the 5-second rule, you know, one that talks about if you drop food somewhere.
At Las Catarinas.
Yeah, well, we're not at Las Catarinas, but we got talking about the germiest places. Can you tell me, of these three choices, which place in your house is the germiest? Is it the toilet seat? Is it the kitchen sponge? Or is it your mouth? The number of bacteria. Toilet seat, kitchen sponge, or your mouth. And it's a multiple choice. First caller at 885-3565 or 1-800-950-KAHI, or that's 5244. Anyway, we're back to our discussion of colon cancer surgery with Dr. Bradshaw.
Well, I think we actually have our callers already. And who do we have on the line?
We actually, somebody's eager.
Somebody's listening.
Oh, it's Bonnie.
Bonnie.
All right, Bonnie. I can't hear Bonnie, though.
Sorry.
Oh, there she is.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me now? It sounds like a Verizon commercial or something. Yeah.
Sprint or Verizon.
Okay, Bonnie.
It's the mouth.
She said it.
I'm sorry,
she
Bonnie.
The mouth?
Oh, yes, the mouth. Where are you calling from, Bonnie?
I'm in Auburn.
Oh, it sounds like you're much farther away, like the dark side of the moon or something. Okay, well, stay on the line. Mike will get your information, and we'll have this certificate for Las Catarinas ready to go.
Thanks.
All right.
We may have another caller
with a question.
We'll find out.
All right.
So where we were leaving off was once you discover the cancer and you do the operation, you talked a little about the operation, what is post-op life like for somebody who's had cancer, colon cancer treated?
Well, we were talking a little bit about the advantages of the laparoscopic surgery. And in general, there's about a day less in the hospital. So people are, on average, getting out of the hospital in 5 days after surgery. And one of the things people are very scared about with colon surgery is that they will need a colostomy. A colostomy is a bag where your stool comes into a bag on your side.
So your colon, instead of going out its normal hole, is rerouted and comes
into a plastic bag. We actually almost never have to do that. The times where we have to do that is if there's an obstruction, and as we talked about, sometimes the people come in when the colon cancer has sort of grown closed. There's so much stool behind the obstruction that we're usually not able to safely put it back together in those circumstances. And sometimes they need it. It's usually temporary. And sometimes if people actually perforate, if they get a hole in their colon, they spill bacteria into their abdomen, they need a colostomy under those circumstances too. But almost always when someone's diagnosed with colon cancer, especially if it's early at colonoscopy, we're able to put them back together and their bowels move normally. Now, we usually take out between a quarter and a third of the colon when we take out a colon cancer. And we need to do that because we need to take out the lymph nodes that drain that area of the colon too. It turns out that we talked about your colon's about 5 feet long, and you can lose a good portion of it and not notice. Some people have a little bit of increased frequency of bowel movements, and you know, we sort of talk about how many does a normal person bowel movements have during the day. They may have if they go once every 2 days, they may go once a day. It's usually not a big disruption to their lifestyle. Colon cancers that are low in the colon, near to the bottom, to the anus, there's a portion of the colon there called the rectum. And the rectal cancers are a little bit harder to take out because they're down in the pelvis, down surrounded by the bones of your hips. And it turns out that the rectum has a storage capacity, a storage function to it that, you know, you're minding your own business and you're, I don't mean this to be gross, but you think, oh, I've got to have a bowel movement. I may need to do that sometime soon. But you usually have a little bit of time, and your rectum sort of expands and fills up, and then you do your business and go on with your life. After rectal cancer surgery, sometimes there's a little less expansion, and the scarring and the change in the anatomy, people have a little bit more urgency. And so sometimes they think, I got to have a bowel movement, but I got to have it right now. And so there's a little bit of that kind of change in function. Most of the time, as years go by, that improves. And so early after surgery, after rectal cancer surgery, people may have a little rectal urgency, we call it. But that usually improves, and usually a few years after the operation, they're normal, and they lead normal lives and eat whatever they want.
What kind of screening do you have to do after?
There's actually a blood test that we do on people that have colon cancer. Is called carcinoembryonic antigen, or CEA, and it's not always elevated in people. It's not a good screening test for just to say people that have never had cancer, but once you have cancer, if the CEA starts coming back up again, it's a sign that there may be some colon cancer growing in you. So the recommendations are for CEA levels drawn every 3 months for the first 2 years after surgery.
Okay, and you brought us to the end of the colon, and that brings us to the end of our show also. We thank you for listening to Medically Speaking Radio. We are on every Saturday at 10 o'clock. Hour-long show takes us to 11. We're very glad to have Dr. Barton Bradshaw on the show. Thanks for joining us this week.
Great to be here. Thanks
for
having me.
We're always glad to have you, and we look forward to having you in the future, too, to talk about more general surgery topics.
Thank you.
You can become a fan or like us on Facebook if you'd like. You can also watch the videos at medicallyspeakingradio.com. Please let our sponsors know you like the show. That would be Sutter-Auburn Faith Hospital, Auburn Medical Group, and Sutter-Auburn Hospice. And as usual, this is Dr. Mark Vaughn, Larry Finney, and this time Dr. Barton Bradshaw telling all of our listeners to stay in good health.